This is session 334, the pros and cons of writing confessional memoir in the Mormon milieu. According to Webster, to confess means to admit or acknowledge something damaging or inconvenient to oneself, to unburden one's sins or the state of one's conscience to God or to a priest. Though there's no sinner's chair or confessional box with a priest built into the LDS ward house, there is a bishop's office and the temple interview where one is supposed to face his or her bishop and declare his or her moral rectitude and worthiness. Is confession something that is supposed to be handled between God and LDS bishop and the injured and offending parties? Doctrine and Covenants 42:88 says, "And if thy brother or sister offend thee, thou shalt take him or her between him or her and thee alone." Or can a confession have value outside that office? According to me, the word confession means to unburden, unload, relieve, depressurize, clean the barnacles off the hull of the ship. In these days of talk shows, reality shows, and the sharing of the deepest secrets, during the 20 years when I was teaching creative nonfiction at Vermont College, and while I was writing my own confessional memoir about the dissolution of a 33-year temple marriage, my falling apart and pulling myself back together again, there were always two nagging questions. What is the value of keeping a confession private and behind closed doors? Number two, what can be gained from sharing one's confession on a broader scale? So, I've invited some incredible writers here to be with you today. I'm so pleased and I can't wait to hear what they have to say. Holly Welker, over here, has a PhD in English literature from the University of Iowa. Her poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and scholarship have appeared in the publications ranging from the New Era, the New York Times, Best American Essays, to Bitch. Kevin Holsworth is the winner of the Sunstone competition recently and has a fabulous story called Silver Wings about two essays ago. You're not in Wyoming teaching anymore, but where are you teaching now?
Weber State.
He's in the process of moving to Weber State where he'll be teaching. Stephen Carter, PhD, editor of Sunstone, studied narrative studies at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he is also the editor of Sunstone magazine and has a new book which is just out and is in the bookstore, and it's called What of the Night, and it's a collection of his essays. Bruce Jorgensen teaches literature and writing at BYU. He's published poems, short stories, literary criticism, and literary interviews. And he and I have had a long-running discussion on this particular subject, so can't wait to hear what he has to say. So let's begin with Holly, Kevin, Stephen, Bruce, and then I will end the remarks.
A couple years ago, I actually gave a whole big long paper on the difference between confession and testimony. I argued that confession is really not that important in Mormonism, and testimony, of course, is much more important. It's one of the main things we do, and so I'm not going to talk about that so much. I focused more on the pros and cons part of Phyllis's title and this issue of danger. And a danger of doing absolutely anything is that you'll do it badly. In an introduction to her own autobiography, theologian Karen Armstrong writes, "Autobiography must be one of the most challenging genres because it becomes impossible to keep humiliating glimpses of one's former self at bay." I think that might definitely be true for someone like Armstrong, who spent 7 years as a nun and was trained in the art of ruthless self-scrutiny. But for the average person trained merely in the art of occasional disclosure, nothing is easier to write than abysmally bad autobiography. As I know from having both read and written it, bad autobiography can take many forms. A very common one is too much information, and not information of a particularly personal or intimate nature, but just too much information, period. This happens frequently when an autobiography is based on a journal. Instead of providing interesting narrative, meaningful character development, and cogent analysis, writers cut and paste large sections of their journal, then pretty up the prose a little bit. But it's still a journal, complete with minutiae about mundane meals, banal shopping trips, and Family gatherings, utterly unremarkable, even to people who attended them. The idea seems to be that if it happened, it's interesting, but that's simply not true, not in life, and certainly not in art. Memoir like this is the literary equivalent of being shown every last vacation photo taken by someone you don't know very well. Yes, I've done it. Yes, I'm doing my best to stop. Later this year, I have a review of the New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance, a memoir by Elna Baker, coming out in Dialogue. I found it a problematic book to review, one reason being that the narrator seemed very unaware of certain things she was communicating about herself. She was not in control of her narrative. These humiliating glimpses of one's former self that Karen Armstrong finds impossible to keep at bay, Baker succeeds in certain ways. Which is not to say that she depicts herself only in flattering ways. She reveals plenty of blemishes. Much of the memoir is about her body and how much she hates it because it is fat. She also recounts many foolish things she does in her attempt to find love. But it seems that no one has ever pointed out certain problems in her ways of looking at herself and the world. The idea seems to be that if I haven't thought of this way of viewing my story, no one else will either. So I don't need to ask some cranky, severe person to read my manuscript as critically as is humanly possible and point out to me every weakness and inconsistency they see. I know, it hurts to be edited. But it hurts worse to read scathing reviews of your work when it's in print. Here's an example of what I mean about Baker's blind spots. When her Mormon boyfriend proposes, she fasts for 2 days, then goes to the temple and offers the following prayer. God, I've decided to marry Hayes. Is this the right thing to do? Soon she gets a response. Yes, 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 all through me. Yes, do. Which seems pretty conclusive, except for two things. One, the boyfriend decides soon thereafter not to. The boyfriend decides soon thereafter not to propose, and two, Baker realizes she doesn't really want to marry him after all. Eventually, she even acknowledges that he never even made her happy. I must ask, how unaware of your own mind and motivation must you be to need an answer from something outside yourself to tell you whether to marry a person who has never made you happy? And isn't the fact that the supposedly divine guidance from the Holy Ghost so off base here somehow worthy of her scrutiny? Which she never does. She never stops to consider the fact that she wants the Holy Ghost to give her absolutely incontrovertible, eternal evidence that her entire way of approaching her life is accurate and appropriate and never needs to change. You know, it's freaky. Anyway, all right, So the question I ask, isn't the fact that the supposedly divine guidance from the Holy Ghost so off base worthy of some scrutiny? Well, yes and no. Yes, because it's a big problem in the coherence of this individual text. No, because within the larger body of Mormon autobiography in general, scrutinizing this would create more incoherence in terms of what Mormon autobiography is really supposed to do. As we all know, Mormonism depends on testimony, on public disclosure of personal experiences. It's not just that one of our primary ways of creating community and experiencing spirituality is sharing faith-promoting stories from our individual lives. It's that we relate personal anecdotes when we teach Sunday school. It's that we keep journals, often with the expectation that our progeny will read them, and we hope also, at least some of us do, that President Kimball was right and that someday the angels may quote from them. We are a church of autobiographers. But as a church, if not as individuals, we have particular expectations about what an autobiography or a life story should do, promote faith. The idea here, which I have heard stated explicitly, is that you should be able to mold every story you tell into one that promotes faith. And if you can't shape it to that end, you shouldn't tell it. As the abstract of a panel yesterday on Unpleasant Truths pointed out, the stories found in most LDS publications almost always result in a predictably happy ending, but life doesn't usually wrap up so tidily, adding that, while it can be terrifying to open up about heartbreaks and disappointments, there are surprising benefits. One of these benefits is maintaining the integrity of your experience and not trying to deceive yourself into believing that loss and failure feel good. They don't. Which is not to deny that good things can come from them, but that rarely happens without a lot of work. Slapping a smiley face or an unearned happy ending onto a story of heartbreak is a good way to ruin what could actually offer meaningful, moving insight into the human condition. I have outlined three ways we can write bad autobiography. Too much information, failing to see all that we reveal to others, and trying to force stories from our lives to support agendas they don't fit. So how do we avoid and fix those problems? One is to be clear about what we're writing and why. When we write autobiography, we're telling a personal, contingent, particular truth. It is something of a truism that fiction contains deeper truths than nonfiction, a paraphrase of Aristotle's claim that poetry is a more philosophical and a higher thing than history, for poetry tends to express the universal, history the particular. The important feature of poetry here is not that it's in verse. Aristotle acknowledges that the poet and the historian differ not by writing in verse or prose. The work of Herodotus might be put into verse, and it would still be a species of history, with meter no less than without it, but that it's imaginative, not what actually happened, but what could happen. And that, Aristotle claims, is what makes poetry universal. That, of course, is an argument rooted in a particular time and place. The notion that anything is universal has lost considerable currency. But despite the devaluation of the universal, the particular has not enjoyed a corresponding rise in estimation, at least not in aesthetic terms. The claim persists that personal nonfiction is more about an arrogant vaunting of self than an attempt to understand something meaningful about the human condition. Notwithstanding the arguments and evidence presented by numerous philosophical and mystical traditions regarding the importance of living an examined life, of knowing oneself and understanding one's motives and behaviors, the fact remains that nonfiction's aesthetic standing is inferior to that of fiction, to everyone, that is, with the possible exceptions of Mormons. This becomes vitally important if one is dealing with subject matter like loss of faith or religious trauma and plans to write for an audience that includes believers. In these cases, Aristotle is correct about the difference between the universal and the particular. Such stories must be offered as true because all that makes them believable is the fact that they happened. He writes that tragedians still keep to real names, the reason being that what is possible is credible. What has not happened, we do not feel at once to be feel sure to be possible, but what has happened is manifestly possible, otherwise it would not have happened. Though I should add that there's this really great theorist of autobiography named Philippe Lejeune who says, in spite of the fact that autobiography is impossible to write and does not exist, I continue to believe in it. No audience of devout Mormons would be satisfied with most of my writings, for instance, if I offered them as fiction, the fact that these works fail to follow the standard format for faith-promoting and therefore satisfying and satisfactory stories matters a great deal. It matters that the narrator, writer in my works, rejects the church, and thus the ending is not, to a conventional Mormon audience, including the members of my family, a happy or even a sensible ending. Instead, the stories are incomprehensibly unredeemed tragedy. Therefore, they must be memoirs to claim a certain literary legitimacy. I think this implies in some ways to Phyllis's most recent memoir as well, and it also applies to Elna Baker's books, though I'm not convinced that Elna has figured that out. Another way we avoid or correct these problems is by heeding the very sage advice of Oscar Wilde. In The Critic as Artist, Wilde argues that without the critical faculty, there is no artistic creation at all worthy of the name, then goes on to discuss that fine spirit of choice and delicate instinct of selection by which the artist realizes life for us and gives to it a momentary perfection. That spirit of choice, that subtle tact of omission, is really the critical faculty in one of its most characteristic moods, and no one who does not possess that critical faculty can create anything at all in art. In other words, one of the most important faculties an artist can develop is the one that tells him or her not what to include, but what to exclude. You have to know what to leave out. The need for this skill is by no means limited to Mormons. It's something Faulkner was addressing in his advice to kill your darlings, meaning cut passages of your writing that you love for their own sake and not for the way they support your text and its overall goals. But what if your goal is to record every single detail of your life? Well, then you need to reevaluate your goal. You need to be more critical of it. I believe that one of the dangers of writing autobiography and fiction and poetry in a Mormon milieu is that Mormons are not trained to be sufficiently critical and that we don't have enough Mormon criticism. But thank God for Sunstone, right? Okay. Wilde argues that an age, and I personally would add, a church that has no criticism is either an age in which art is immobile, hieratic, and confined to the reproduction of formal types, or an age that possesses no art at all. There have been critical ages that have not been creative in the ordinary sense of the word, ages in which the spirit of man has sought to set in order the treasures of his treasure house, to separate the gold from the silver and the silver from the lead, to count over the jewels and to give names to the pearls, and I would add, of great price. But there has never been a creative age that has not also been critical, for it is the critical faculty that invents fresh forms. The tendency of creation is to repeat itself. It is to the critical instinct that we owe each new school that springs up and each new mold that art finds ready to its hand. As an example of the accuracy of this statement, I call your attention to the fact that I call your attention to the creation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Whether you believe that God or Joseph Smith is its author, the fact remains that the church was instituted in 1830 because Joseph Smith felt there was something lacking in every church available to him, so he exercised his critical faculty. In order to write good Mormon autobiography, we must be exquisitely critical. We must criticize our own choices and develop that subtle tact of omission that helps us leave out irrelevant details. We must strive to evaluate our beliefs, lives, and assertions as our harshest critics would. Of course, not in the first draft, because you would paralyze yourself that way, but certainly in our penultimate drafts, the ones we send our agents before she makes us revise them yet again. I believe strongly that it is only by exercising rigorously our critical faculty that we could stop worrying about when we will see fulfilled the prophecy about Mormons producing our own Miltons and Shakespeares and create a meaningful literary canon that speaks not only to us, but to the world at large.
I thought it was Kevin next, 6 minutes.
Jude, you talk good. Yeah, well, I'm going to leave some of the discussion to my more learned and accomplished colleagues. I feel very humble to be able to speak to you today. And I'd like to read a quote from an Italian poet from the 15th century. To me, writing about Mormonism is something that I've come to naturally and gradually, but not exclusively, because people in the outside world are interested. Who am I? Well, I was raised a Mormon in Utah, and so that always interests people in the outside world. They want to know more about it, and so I think that anyone who has that experience can write about it, and should, because the outside world is very curious. Just to read a couple of things from my memoir. In East Coast exile, I quite naturally tried to deny my Mormon roots. Partly this was because I grew tired of the two standard, "Oh, you're from Utah," questions. No, I was not a Mormon, and not everyone in Utah is, and yes, polygamy is actually under control in my immediate family. If my interlocutor was not satisfied, I'd generally add that yes, yes, of course, I have had a torrid affair with Marie Osmond. And, you know, I think part of it's the isolation of Utah and its fascination with the outside world. It was fun to watch Colbert and Jon Stewart show, you know, with their New York writers, show one version of Salt Lake, which is a whacked theocracy. So anyway, I think people are always going to be interested in that. One of the things I want to talk about that has, I think, to do with the dangers of memoir is what's happened to me in Wyoming. I've lived in Wyoming for 13 years. I arrived before this many years before the boom. I lived through a boom, and now I'm seeing the tail end of the boom. And it took me that long to understand our great neighboring state. But the reason this is relevant is, to me, part of what you do in memoir, if you choose to, is to be political and to try to say, well, this is what I've learned and this is what I believe in. I think that's easier if you're a nature writer because you have this lovey relationship with the landscape. And there would be no reason to live in Wyoming if you didn't love the landscape, since there really is not very much else there. And because you love the landscape and love your favorite places, whether you, you know, take photographs or blast a wapiti or watch the wolves, you love it. And so when you see it being destroyed by government agencies and et cetera, it makes you unhappy, and so you speak up about it and blah, blah, blah. You're familiar with this environmental activism, no? I made a lot of enemies in Wyoming, and I thought that that was okay. I thought that was part of our democratic process. But I have learned that the essence of Wyoming is a very black and white worldview. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And people in Wyoming really don't want it to change. Having watched a governor go through 8 years, he was a Democrat, but you'd never know it. And absolutely nothing changed. It's still a state dependent completely on extractive industries for its economic livelihood. And of course, because I was a state employee, it got me into trouble. And that was my terrible mistake. You know, I grew up in Utah, so I was familiar with censorship. But I think in a lot of ways, it's more intense in a place like Wyoming. But there's only one Wyoming, so there's no place like Wyoming. One of the things I think that Holly mentioned that was very worth thinking about is putting that happy face on narrative, whether it's the, you know, the missionary going on a mission story or the testimonial or whatever. And I think that you're right. What happens is I think people tend to caricature Mormons, and you know, obviously on TV you see that. I think that the difficult thing is to have some sort of a reality based character that's somehow interesting because of the quirkiness. Journaling, I think, is that you're absolutely right about that. You know, most of that quotidian stuff isn't at all interesting. I wanted to talk a little bit about my story, Silver Wings, because I wanted to talk about some of the roots of that story. I'm not sure it's confessional at all, but I first got the idea for Silver Wings because of what a friend of mine was in Wayne County, where I spent a lot of time. A friend of mine was talking about something that was going on down at Notam. I don't know if you know Notam, but it has three houses, and it's right next to Capitol Reef, but it's basically kind of a ghost town. And I had a student who wrote an essay about how drought and environmentalists have caused local ranchers to sail their cattle. And he spelled it S-A-I-L. So I said to my friend Doug Campbell, I said, yeah, this kid, Zeke Coombs from Hanksville or whatever, he said that drought and environmentalists had forced ranchers to sail their cattle. And he said, oh, yeah. Every windy day, Golden and Arlo Durfee sail their cattle because you know how windy it is down in Notam. So I filed that away and said, I got to write about that sometime. My grandfather raised guinea pigs. He lived in American Fark. And he raised guinea pigs. I think he sold them to BYU. They used them in the cafeteria on Wednesdays. The mystery meat was my grandfather's guinea pigs. And he had, you know, 1,200 of them in the top of his barn. So, you know, there's a very distinct smell and noise that guinea pigs made. I don't know if you're familiar with that anyway. So as far as tragic ending goes, I got a guinea pig from my grandfather, and I took it to my sixth grade class for show and tell. And Stacy Pino, took a pencil and stabbed my guinea pig in the eye and killed it. Killed my guinea pig. And so I was obviously deeply affected by that experience. But see, that's the sort of tragic ending that Mormon discussion in Mormon memoir perhaps needs, where things are just awful, awful things happen, and there's no redemption. One final comment. My dear beloved mother has Alzheimer's and is in late stages, but she still remembers to put a smiley face on her experience. It's as though she's talking to herself. She says to me every time I see her, "Well, you can't just sit around and be miserable." Right? And it's like, well, I would be miserable. There's nothing wrong with being miserable. Life is difficult. Life is suffering. But, you know, she still remembers, because all her life she's been taught that you must be positive, you must be positive, you must be positive. The world is so much different, I think, from that in many ways, and being willing to embrace it is hopefully our future as Mormon writers.
Imagine yourself telling three stories. The first is the story you tell your best friend on the phone late at night. It's the one you're telling through your tears. My boyfriend broke up with me. My child is very ill. I just lost my job. Most likely, your narrative is halting and messy. It jumps back and forth in time as different events occur to you and thrust themselves into your story. And you frequently punctuate your ramblings with phrases like, "Why is this happening?" or "What am I going to do?" The second is a story that you tell a coworker or a gym buddy a week or so after the fact. It's much cleaner now. The events have started to order themselves. They've lined up into a semblance of cause and effect. And you've begun to assign values to the events. And now you can maintain your composure much better than the first time you told the story. But the story is still in flux. It hasn't found its final form yet, and meaning is still up for grabs. The third story is the one you tell in testimony meeting a few months later. Though it has many of the same events the first two stories did, this narrative is decidedly different. It's filled with phrases like, "I thought then that," and "But there was a purpose for this," and "I see now that." Perhaps you are weeping this time, just as you were when you were telling the first story, but this time it's for a completely different reason. You're weeping because your story has managed to find its way into a meaningful form. It can't buffet you around anymore with its ambiguities and questions. The story has been cast and cooled into the form that you're going to repeat to people every time the chance presents itself. Its meaning is set. So all of us have gone through these stages of storytelling many times. It's the way that the human mind works. In order to move information from your working memory to your long-term memory, you need two things. You need sleep, and you need a story. I'm sure I could find some evidence for that somewhere. Terry Pratchett, the author, has described stories as streams and rivers that are running down a mountain. The larger a story it is, the more power it has, the more able it is to pull its surroundings into its current. So if you find yourself heading in the same direction as a large narrative river, you're likely to be swept into it. Now, even though you're swept into it, the river is still following the same path that it was following to begin with. It's telling the same story that it is always told. And since you're traveling with it, its story is now your story. These narrative rivers are all around us, and they're hungry for our lives. When I first started writing the personal essays that would end up populating the book you're going to go buy after this session, this is what it looks like. What of the night? Thanks. when I was first writing the personal essays in this book, I was in the first stage of trying to tell stories about what it was like for me to be a Mormon. Now, I was very lost and confused because Mormonism which was once an unshakable foundation of my life, had turned quite liquid. I thought that I was living high on a mountaintop, but suddenly I was at sea, and I could no longer see the lower lights burning. As I wrote down the bits and pieces of the story of my life, I started to realize that they were being fought over by things that were larger than me, and these were the giant stories, the rivers, the big narrative cultural rivers that had been a part of my life for as long as I could remember. Now, both rivers had very strong opinions about which way my little story should go. The first, the river that flowed through hundreds of conference talks and thousands of testimonies, wanted to take my floundering little stories and guide them into a current that made them into mere flotsam, floating insignificantly on the great gospel river. It wanted to roll them into an ending where testimonies were born, tears were shed, hugs shared. The other current, was heading straight out of the church. It took my concerns very seriously, and it showed me which boat to jump in before it was too late, and that was a very strong current, and in many ways it was very enticing to me. Now, being in the midst of a religious crisis, as I'm sure you all know, is one of the most painful experiences you can go through. Now, both of these rivers, both of these currents, these cultural stories, offered me a way out of the pain, and a pretty quick way, too. But I made a decision that I think was one of the most important that I've made in my life. I resisted both stories. Now, I don't particularly feel like a hero or anything for doing this. It's most likely that I resisted these stories because intuitively I realized that they were both kind of boring. And I hate being bored. I could also tell that neither of these rivers was particularly interested in my individual story, and that hurt my pride. They just wanted one more protein shake to add to their bulk and power. So, resisting both currents, which would have brought me to the third story very quickly, the testimonies story, I actively fought to maintain a place somewhere between the first raw story and the second fledgling story for as long as I could. I did this because I felt that the longer the details of my story could stay in flux, the more I could detect their nuances and explore the multitude of connections among them. Now, I think that keeping oneself in this tension between the two stories, keeping meaning open for as long as possible, is a good way to write personal essays, mainly because novelty and exploration is a hallmark of good writing. But at the same time, as I pursued this path, I found that it put me into a difficult relationship with the rest of my world. Because the rest of my world is most definitely Mormon. My great-great-grandfather, and I'm very proud of him, was the editor of the Swedish version, now tell me if I get this right, of the Times and Seasons. Is that right, Paul? The Mission Magazine, okay. And my grandfather, George, sang in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. So religion is the omnipresent glue that holds my family together across many lines and generations. The way this glue is maintained is by telling stage 3 testimony-type stories whenever we get together. We tell our stories about our ancestors, about ourselves, about our children. So when I started to teach myself how to tell my stories outside the Stage 3 river, I suddenly became an alien. You've probably run across the same problem. Deviating from the testimony way of talking about Mormonism can really throw people off. If you try to do it in public, people will wonder if you're on the road to apostasy, and you'll suddenly become someone's project, and you'll find yourself on the business end of many a testimony. It's as if people are trying to remind you how you're supposed to be talking. So I started to understand early on that my explorations, being couched in a language and in a story context that made even me uncomfortable, would be even more uncomfortable for the people who were close to me. It would cause my parents and my siblings and my extended family stress and possibly even grief if I talked to them about my thoughts in the language of the first and second story types. So I did what anyone would do. I moved to Alaska. And I kept my stories to myself, though not completely, because I did start publishing my personal essays. But I did so in journals that I knew my family never went anywhere near, because I really, really didn't want any of them to read what I had written. I was so frightened that they might see what I had written that whenever I published, I would call the one person in my extended family who reads these kind of publications, my good Uncle Paul, and begged him not to tell anybody. And Paul never told anybody. Thank you, Paul. At least I think so. So if I was so worried about my writing getting the wrong hands, what was I doing publishing it? In The Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell asserts that the reason Jesus is such a powerful religious figure is simply because he suffered. That was it. Suffering is human. When we see someone suffering, we're drawn out of our hiding places. We become more willing to be vulnerable. And it seems to me that suffering happens in the telling of the first and the second story types. Because that's when the events of our lives are still raw, and that's when we're still trying to make sense of them. We can't present a unified story to people. And it's also the time when the power of our life's events haven't yet been consumed by the larger cultural narrative river that's trying to suck us into it. It can still propel us into new places. So story style 3, it gives a nod to suffering, but the storyteller is much too safe in the prefabricated structure where the questions have been answered and laid to rest. But talking in the language of stories number 1 and 2, especially in a public forum, is to own your suffering and to follow it, which makes you vulnerable, especially to those who are closest to you. Such talk is dangerous. And it's very likely that you'll be misunderstood, because most people, when they're listening to you tell a story in a public setting especially, they're listening to you with the ears of story number 3. That's what they're expecting to hear, is a story number 3 structure. But I will promise you that somebody is going to be able to hear you in between stories number 1 and 2. And they are the people who need your story the most. And you are the person who needs them to be able to hear your story in between 1 and 2. Because that is when vulnerability becomes a strength and a method of connection between you and another person, which is what I think we're all seeking the most of. So, the irony of everything that I've been saying is that the essays in this book are stage 3 stories for me. And what I mean by that is that they have been cast, my experiences have been cast into specific molds. And my ability to retell them and to reevaluate them is becoming limited. The events that I talk about in there happened long enough ago that I don't remember them now with much clarity. This was brought to my mind very forcefully when Charlotte England asked me to write my remembrance of Gene England for a biography of him. And I started writing down a couple of hundred words, and I was getting kind of stuck. And so I went back and I read the essay that I wrote about him in Dialogue many, many years ago. And it was a revelation. I didn't remember half the things that I was reading about in there. And so I realized it's all gone. It's gone into the ether, and this is what I have. This is my memory. And so I just ended up sending her that essay. I'm sure she already had it. I think it's on the website now. Oh, I messed up my place. Okay, so I understand that the stories that make up my essays are very much cast and cooled. They are my memory, and they are my testimony. And as time goes on, I'll have less and less ability to reconsider them in depth. I'd feel a sense of loss about this, except that I know that they would be likely cast into a story or forgotten by now anyway. So instead, I'm grateful to my past self for putting in the work and for staying with that suffering, for resisting the easy story, and for letting my life experience create a story of their own. But for those of you who do read my work, I hope that the sense of the first and second stories, raw and in flux, remains still interacting and still full of possibilities. I was talking to a friend yesterday about his definition of the still small voice, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this. He believes that the still small voice is the unique voice inside of yourself, sort of your creative abilities. He worries that our still small voice is too often overshouted and overrun, not just by the cultural river of the world, but by the culture of the church. Now, I like that metaphor. And I agree that too often the large river finds us too soon. It sweeps away the details, the possibility, and the power of our stories into itself before they can begin to grow. We need to listen carefully to them because the river's roar is deafening and its appetite is insatiable. Perhaps even with all of our efforts, we'll only manage to create a small spring or a creek. After all, my book is pretty small. But despite the size, the product will be ours, and it will be nourishing. Thank you.
The first confession I must make, I now think, after hearing those presentations, is that, like I suspect most members of the church that was founded by Joseph Smith, I am so far a lifelong member of that other great club he founded, the No Man Knows My History Club. I am neither a confessional memoirist, nor do I expect to become one, although I've been surprised before, and I'm often wrong. The second confession is that in responding to Phyllis's invitation, which was hard to refuse because we've been friends for a long time, it might have been prudent to have refused, I've had time amid a massive remodel and addition project on our house, which makes the writing of two consecutive sentences nearly impossible. I've managed to write down some notes, which I fear are consecutive only in having been written in the sequence they happened to have been written in. So, and I'll be picking up on some of the language in Phyllis's description of the panel. We'll see if this. I hope this will be some sort of little rivulet contributing to the story that is getting constructed here. Tell all. Oh, that's impossible, isn't it? And if you did manage it, the all would be a bigger book than the world could hold. Just as John, at the very end of his gospel, remarks of the many other things which Jesus did, if they should be written, everyone, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. It's always a matter of telling some. And the question is, tell what? Now, I suppose in our popular culture these days, tell all means tell all my secrets, or at least some of my sexual secrets. In celebrity memoirs, who all I've slept with, and in some celebrated non-celebrity memoirs, who abused me and how. Now, I've not read a single one of these kinds of memoirs all the way through, but I'll bet that even they do not tell all. Certainly not every detail. That would be too much information. And in Mormon culture, I suppose the resistance to either of these sorts of tell-all memoir from within our community could indeed be very high. But the word confessional really interests me, too. Augustine of Hippo, the good bishop, wrote the first substantial confessional memoir that I'm aware of as having come down to us in the Western literary tradition, and still surely one of the best. Perhaps Rousseau, who did tell some of his sexual secrets that many even today might not tell, is still Augustine's main rival. Gary Wills has recently reminded us that the Latin title of Augustine's Confessiones might best be rendered in English as testimony. And we're, of course, having strong culture-specific reference and resonance for us. And in fact, maybe, as I think Holly suggested, or maybe Phyllis's definition at the outset, suggests, I don't know, maybe our testimony is nothing like Augustine's testimony, for reasons that have already, I think, been suggested. Augustine, or at least his persona in the Confessions, addresses his telling to God as if it were a sustained private confessional prayer. In the very first paragraph, you encounter a sentence that goes something like, "You made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you," for instance. And there's constant address to the divine other throughout that book. Yet Augustine the bishop clearly meant his confessional memoir addressed to God to be published, to be overheard by his local flock for their edification in the faith, and more widely by any in the late Roman Empire to whom the text might come and be read. And you wonder if, with the barbarians at the gates, he imagined how long his testimony would resound, how widely it would be scattered into how many different tongues, how many would find in it, as I have and as I continue to do, something like the edification he intended, how it would go on telling all who read it in whatever tongue what a life of intelligent, examined faith and a soul's path toward God might feel like. The errores, the wanderings, that become a via, a way. Any Mormon might wish that his or her bishop had written and published such a confession, such a testimony. And all the more that at least a few apostles and prophets had done so. Yet they too seem to belong to that great club, the No Man Knows My History Club. So we seem unlikely ever to read anything of the sort from our leaders. Not anything that would probe and expose, even to as modest a degree as Augustine did, the sins from pear-stealing to carnal concupiscence to curiosity. That one bugs him even after his conversion. He's still plagued by curiosity. And you have to understand his definition of that, and I will not go into that. Or the intellectual struggles, especially those, the sheer difficulty for Augustine, the trained rhetorician, of accepting the sermo humilis, the humble style of Scripture, or the toil of working into and out of competing doctrines like Manichaeism. Will any prophet or apostle ever tell us such a story? I'd be eager to read it, but I doubt I'll get the chance in this life where the edification might be of some use to me. I confess, I think I've learned more about how spiritual life feels, about what sin is, about what conversion is and feels like from Augustine than from any sermon or book I have yet heard or read within my own faith community. I confess, too, that this might just signify my failure to read the right books or to listen attentively enough at church or to general conference. Still, it has long seemed to me that for all the truth-telling and testimony-bearing in our culture, we get to hear and read very little that tells enough of the concrete, particular, and personal truth, which again I think Polly spoke of, that might be most edifying to us, the amount of, and direction of the edification varying, of course, with each singular hearer. Perhaps we have a few too many preformed judgments, prejudices about what is edifying and what is not. I'm hoping maybe we can talk about what is felt to be edifying, although we've got a general sketch of it already, the story that ends happily and in a spiritually uplifting way. That's what's edifying. Certain topics are probably not thought to be edifying, like my struggles with Manichaeism, if I had them. I haven't had them, I don't think. There's a passage in Paul's second letter to Timothy that has puzzled me since I snagged on it not quite 3 years ago in my then new assignment to teach the New Testament in one of my Ward's Gospel Doctrine classes. Now I'm struggling with the Old Testament. Paul writes to Timothy, aiming to edify him for his calling, "But continue thou in the things which thou hast learned and hast been assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned, and that from a child thou hast known the holy Scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, truly finished unto all good works. The translators of the Authorized Version did as well as they could with Paul's Greek here. His words, rendered literally enough by Holy Scriptures, were hagia grammata. Forgive me if I don't say the Greek as one should. I'm less than a novice. But in the next verse, the words rendered all Scripture were passa graphe, which might also be translated all writing. I'm not aware that Paul was given to elegant variation in his diction, or that the Greek of his time would have obliged him to use the word graphe in the next phrase. The switch there from hagia grammata, holy letters, sacred letters, you could render that if you wanted, to passa graphe has intrigued me. Could he have intended by that shift a shift to a wider category, all writing? Why not? I hardly deserve the name of novice at New Testament Greek, and I'm very homemade at that. I've read that Paul's sentence, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable, etc., in which the AV translators scrupulously italicized both is's to indicate that they have added those words, is not entirely clear in the Greek. Did he mean given by inspiration of God as restrictive modifier on all writing, so that only that writing out of all writing inspired of God is profitable? Or did he mean all writing is inspired of God and is therefore profitable? Perhaps I'm playing fast and loose with his passa graphe as implying a larger category than hagia grammata. Still, in Paul's time, the Jewish canon had not been fully and finally established, and he was writing this letter before anyone can have thought of establishing a Christian canon. So what might he have included within all Scripture or all writing? We know that he occasionally quoted Greek poets and other sources for the edification of his addressees. It's clear. It's tantalizing to wonder if Paul might well have meant that all writing is inspired of God and is, therefore, profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, etc. As a teacher of literature and writing, that's a claim I'd be willing to try to defend at length and with vigor. Few who have thought much about the value of stories in or out of the church would dispute the general claim that Reynolds Price has put this way. A need to tell and hear stories is essential to the species Homo sapiens, second in necessity apparently after nourishment and before love and shelter. Millions survive without love or home, almost none in silence. It's a staggering claim, isn't it? But I believe it. The classicist and philosopher Martha Nussbaum, and I'll be done soon, gives the need to tell and hear stories a moral philosophical inflection, asserting the role of poetic or literary texts in moral learning. Certain truths, she says, about human experience can best be learned by living them in their particularity. Nor can this particularity be grasped solely by thought itself by itself. As Aeschylus and Sophocles might well have argued, it frequently needs to be apprehended through the cognitive activity of imagination, emotions, even appetitive feelings, through putting oneself inside a problem and feeling it. But we cannot all live in our own overt activities through all that we ought to know in order to live well. Here, literature, with its stories and images, enters in as an extension of our experience, encouraging us to develop and understand our cognitive emotional responses. In her context, a close reading of Plato's Phaedrus, Nussbaum is most concerned with love stories, as she will be in her next major book, Love's Knowledge, which expansively develops the position sketched here in the quotation I've just given. For Mormons, if we grant the claim that we need stories as an extension of our own experience in order to learn things we ought to know in order to live well, the next question might be, what stories? And we're back to my starting point, which will also be my ending point, that since no one can tell all, and if anyone could, it's doubtful anyone else would have the time to listen to the telling. Tell what? Thank you.
All right, so you're a good Mormon, and you like to write, and you've made a few mistakes. You want to come to terms with them. What do you do about that? Well, you think, well, maybe I'll keep a personal journal, as I've been told to do. Okay. And then you say, well, I really want to speak my truth, that the truth is supposed to make you free. Okay, and you still at the same time want to strive for perfection and to be perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. But then you say, well, what is perfection? And who defines what that is? You believe it's best not to deviate from the gospel teachings, the scriptures, the iron rod, the words from the prophet, but you're not exactly sure what the truth is. Are we talking about the capital T truth or the small t truth? You want to follow the teachings of our Savior, but you've made mistakes, and you're wandering out in the cold. You're wondering if there really is redemption. Then you remember that you believe in eternal progression, that you can grow every day in every way, that you can continue toward a greater understanding of God's ways. And you think about the fact that charity never faileth, and you think, maybe I could write my story. And you turn to the written page first, because there's not a judge there except for you, who's the worst judge of all. And you begin to write what you need to say. Everything I've written 7 books, I have always written because I needed to know an answer to something. And I could go into that, but that's another subject. So when I wrote this memoir, that's been a very difficult one for me to write. It's a 12-year project, and I started as a novel, and I didn't want to own all these things, and I thought I could write a really famous chick novel and make money. But as I wrote along, and I was just realizing this is not going to work, because I'm not really, I can't put on the mask here. I can't make these characters. I have to tell this story I need to tell. Okay, so here's a lot of the questions. I had an argument for the whole 12 years about whether I should even be writing this story, and then publishing was far in the distance, but I had big, big questions about that. And these questions were, we're always told that, number one, people should keep their own counsel, and they should settle the matters among themselves. Don't take your burden basket to the neighbor's house. Who wants to know about your troubles anyway? Some readers will say, this is more information than I want to know. Write something that entertains me. So you get a myriad of responses about telling your story. Okay, number two, it isn't ethical to tell other people's secrets. This is a very valuable argument. A memoir invariably includes other players, other people. Is it the writer's right to tell others' stories or secrets? Do you actually know the other person's or people's stories that you've referenced in your memoir, or are you only writing about them from your perspective? And I will add that the memoir I wrote is about a 33-year marriage, and obviously has to include my husband at the time. It would be interesting to write about the marriage if you write about yourself. when I finished this book, I gave it to David, and I said, you read this, and if there's anything in here that really you object to, or I didn't explain well enough, you let me know. And he did make a few suggestions, and I made a few changes, and he even put some things in there that I would not have put in. But that was one way that I dealt with this. So there are. But I think when you're writing a memoir, you need to remember it is your perspective. This wasn't David's story, this was my story. And he even said that to me as well. Okay, number three, your writing may affect your family adversely. Your children, your grandchildren, when they face the fact that you are less than perfect and face the possibility that the same might be true for them, do you weaken your lineage by confessing your weaknesses? Interesting question. Is it better to keep the stiff upper lip and slog through the battle of life without having to tell everyone about it? These are really important questions, and I'm not mocking them at all, because they're something that I thought about immensely. But luckily, my own particular family, we are very open with each other, and everybody knows everything, and so I didn't write anything that surprised them. Okay, number four, one shouldn't live the kind of life that results in the need to write a confessional memoir. As much as the LDS culture talks about repentance, there is an implicit understanding that if you're a good person, you're occupied with the saving graces. One should not even be familiar with the face of sin. Maybe there are the white lies, the white-collar infringements, or the duping of the ward congregation with yet another Ponzi scheme, but then there are the major sins. And these are major. Violence against each other. Murder, incest, rape, assault, and battery, with adultery, fornication, child or spouse abuse close behind. Most people are understandably more quiet about these matters. Someone who's a good Latter-day Saint might make mistakes, but avoids sin. So again, where's the need to write about it? An acceptable confessional memoir in the LDS culture most likely would have a dang it, ah shucks quality, and would probably deal with not paying sufficient attention to one's family, telling a complicated lie, cheating someone in a business deal, or being tempted by a sexual affair but being saved by the grace of God at the last minute. An LDS person who would admit to a major sin has some big scrambling to do, any person, and they should not be advertising the fact. Number five, writing a confessional memoir sets you up to be judged by others, sets you up for scrutiny and criticism. A few people have asked me why I would ever have to do battle with insecurity. I have really battled with insecurity in my life, and I talk about it in this book. And people say, why are you so insecure? You know, and it's sort of like, this is how it is. So, readers think they know who you are if you write a memoir, and they relate to you as a book rather than as a person or as a work in progress. So just because something's in a book, it's really between two covers and it's really very small compared to a life. Okay, and one more question. Just because you are a writer, does that mean you can write about anything you please? And I think that writers need to ask themselves that question at times, because we get concerned with saying, I want to write the truth and I want to get it out there. And so these are really ethical concerns, all of these that I've mentioned. And they're the thorns in the side of the memoirist in every other religious culture, and in many other cultures, not only religious ones. So, what is the affirmative evidence for writing a confessional memoir, which I believe can be a prayerful, creative approach for coming to terms with one's missteps, mistakes, or errors, or misunderstandings? Number one, to thine own self be true. Latter-day Saints are weaned on telling the impeccable truth to themselves and others. How does that fit into the idea of confession? Maybe it's okay to tell the truth to oneself, but why involve others? Is it narcissistic to publish one's confessions? Is it too self-absorbed and not compatible with a Christ-like life, which, as St. Francis says, seek not to be understood, but to understand? Elie Wiesel, which I'm quoting from your essay, Stephen, says, I believe that whatever we receive, we must share. When I endure an experience, the experience cannot stay with me alone. It must be opened, it must become an offering, it must be deepened and given and shared. There were 20 years of my life where I was attending a lot of different churches. I went to one big mega church which had a sign outside that said, Sinners Welcome Here. Loved it. At the time, I was really happy to go in the doors. But one of the things he said, the preacher was really magnificent, but he says, I don't care if you've been a prostitute, a drug addict, you know, a junkie, whatever you've been. He said, if you make it through and you come to Christ, it's your job to help the people who come behind you. And that really affected me deeply. And I thought, well, okay. That's the reason I can write my story. And if maybe, you know, of course, I have to be holy and say maybe this will help someone. So I think we can make a gift of our story by sharing our difficulties with others who may be struggling in similar ways. It can be valuable to ask if you are pretending to be something you are not, or whether or not you're wearing a mask and pretending to be somebody or something else. You seek transparency and the ability to say, what you see is what you get. I've made mistakes, but I have no wish to hide them anymore. With this act, you decide not to wear the emperor's new clothes and move on to a place beyond blaming other people, beyond fault-finding, beyond self-pity. Number two, many of us feel the need to deal with our dragons, to understand why we've taken some of the twists and turns off to the side and away from the straight and narrow, and whether or not or how that matters to us. In literature, it seems that the universals for all human beings are most often found in those embarrassing, shameful, hurtful things that hold so much power over an individual. I've taught writing for a lot of years, and that's what we always talk about, ultimately, is go to those places that are really hard to write about, because that's where you're going to touch somebody else. That's where you're going to reach somebody else. Robert Louis Stevenson says, "Macerate your subject, let it boil slow, then take off the lid and look in, and there your stuff is, good and bad." Okay, in exercising your personal demons, the worry about the truth being made public is no longer there to catch you by surprise or for someone to uncover and expose. And when you face your dragons, there's a healing process and a repairing of a wound. In mythical terms, you've embarked on the hero's journey, you've entered the labyrinth, you're dealing with the dragons, the sirens, the bugaboos, the boogeyman, the ghosts of your life. You're presented with a puzzle and an enigma. And when you find your way through the conundrum, you're having something to give to yourself as to other people. Number three, seeing what one thinks. Writing is a way to help you literally see what you think and ask yourself if this is really the way something happened, if this is really what you think about it. Maybe you have a lot of indiscriminate hurt and anger inside, but do you really know what that is? Do you have any idea of what the truth is? Oscar Wilde put it simply, "The truth is rarely pure and never simple." Number four, making beauty from the chaos. So much of today's confessional writing is of the kiss-and-tell mentality, talk-show mentality, tell-all, kill the bastard, take him down. But maybe serious writers want to be more than whiners and complainers, or someone who has been offended and is seeking revenge by telling all. And I thank you for your comment about telling all, Bruce. Maybe they want to write something that is ultimately uplifting to the reader, something that would be artistic, something of value. Think of the idea of an amanuensis or a scribe. If writers are scribes, they basically record what they see and observe around them. They are copyists, transferring to paper what they've been told and what needs to be recorded for future posterity. They will have no artistic interaction with their material. They will understand the format they are to follow, and this can be a useful thing. But if writers choose to be artists, is it possible that their purpose is to write what you cannot know before you have written, as Helene Sisu says, just as a painter tries to paint what she cannot paint? A scribe records, an artist pierces the skin of the unknown, sets foot, as Kafka says, in the holy of the holies, where you must take off your shoes, your traveling garment, and lay down your luggage. And under that, you must shed your nakedness and everything that is under the nakedness and everything that hides beneath that. And then the core and the core of the core. Then the remainder and then the residue. And then even the holy of the holies, and let yourself be absorbed by it. Should a book be written to serve the expectations of its audience? Should it be written in a formulaic format with a happy ending and only for entertainment? Should it have good manners and wear Mary Janes? Should a book bear testimony to the truth, or by its very nature, can it only explore the tiny tendril roots of the truth of one's personal experience? Or should a book be something that is dangerous, edgy, something that serves as the axe to break the frozen sea inside of us, as Kafka has written? Why write a book at all if you can't explore unfamiliar territory, the places where you hold your breath because of what might be around the next corner? Thank you. Okay, we have about 20 minutes for questions if you want to do that, and I hope we can get into some good stuff here. Thank you for being here, and thank you all panelists. I really appreciate everything you had to say.
I'm interested in knowing for each of you what has been your most serious difficulty in something that you confessed as you've written, or something, some difficult thing, some dragon that you confessed.
My first book, which is not yet in print, was a memoir about my mission, which I've published bits about it, some of it in Sunstone, other places, but I have such a tidy metaphor, I know I'm halting. It's still very painful. I fell through my neighbor's kitchen roof in a beautiful, Edenic, tropical, paradisical part of Taiwan, and it was a fall in paradise, and I broke a rib, and I then had the daunting task of creating a woman out of a broken rib. And one of the things that was going on, I had dropped a letter off my balcony, and it fell, and of course, seeking the word, I climbed onto my neighbor's roof and fell through it, and all these nice, tidy metaphors. But the fact of the matter is that I descended into despair. I was convinced I was damned because I really honestly believed that there was something inherently immoral about trying to convert Buddhists to Christianity. This is not a thing you're supposed to believe on your mission. I figured the problem was me. And I cried for 9 weeks. I just walked around with tears streaming down my face. I'd walk up to Chinese people and hand them a pamphlet and say, "Do you want a pamphlet about my church? It'll make you really happy." And, you know, not surprisingly, they didn't always take them from me. And I got my first prescription for antidepressants from a trio of atheist Freudian psychiatrists who spoke to me in Mandarin and really wanted to talk to me about my libido, which, you know, was non-existent. A, I was a Mormon virgin, and B, I was suicidally depressed. You know, I didn't really want to get laid at that point. You know, 14 years after this happened, I would sit at my computer and sob and sob and sob and sob and sob. And I guess this is one area where I would argue with you, Stephen, about codifying things and getting to this stage 3 story. It was trauma, and in trauma theory, the story never stops happening. It's always current time, and you're always just barely past, not even in the stage 1 telling, you're always just barely past it happening. So that for me, I mean, it was I have gotten to the point where I can talk about it without crying, but it was trauma, and There's a way in which it will never be better.
You did point out something that I hadn't thought of, and it's good to clarify, which is that the story often becomes codified, and often that directs the way that we tell the story, because that's the way it makes sense in our life. But you're absolutely right that it continues to interact with your life, and to deny that that happens is to be false. The one of the things about confessional memoir is that often you need people feel the need to, well, most people write it from the position of being the victim, and the exploration is painful and awful and traumatizing. And one of the things that I had to do was to write from the point of view of being the aggressor, which is really awful. Because when you're a victim, you can come from a point of righteousness. And when you're the aggressor, you have to repent in front of people and wonder if they're going to forgive you.
I already gave myself a nap, but I'm not going to write a confession no more. I don't understand all the reasons for that. One of them is that I don't find myself all that interested. The poet Philip Levine, I think it was once asked, why do you write so many poems that are the voices of fictional characters? And he's, sometimes people have mistaken the Levine poem for Levine and has had to correct them, but he often writes fictively. And he said, why should I be myself when I can be someone else more interesting? But I will say that every one of the maybe three dozen or so poems that I've so far published, and the six or seven short stories I've all published, of course, they're absolutely true. And no, the poems actually are sort of autobiographical, but I'm not interested in, I just haven't discovered that interest. The only person I say I've ever written was at the request of a friend and former student, Tessa Santiago, who was editing for a while the magazine This People, and she wanted to do, was it This People? I'm getting old and forgetting. She was going to do an issue focused on fathers, and she said, would you write something for me? And it's very hard to resist Tessa's request, and so I wrote a thing called Fathered Semicolon Fathering, a few notes on. And I did discover, for me, part of the difficulty is simply finding the words, and even more than the words, the syntax. The sentence forms in which I can begin to get an actual experience. It's equally difficult creating an imaginary, it seems to me. In this case, among other things, my love for my youngest daughter. How do I tell her? How can I possibly tell her? Or the death of my father, which sneaks into things I've written in all the genres I've tried to write in. Because those things are painful, but also because I'm joyous, and that's hard, you know. Emily Dickinson, you know, I can wade, breathe all the pools of it, but the least push of joy trips up my feet. That's true. As I say, I've already given myself an easy out. I'm not a confessional memoirist. But I have found that writing about personal experience and trying to be true to it and give my sentences the rhythms and the sounds that will, especially if said aloud, will be that experience, or at least the verbal recreation. That's a terrific challenge. I don't know anything harder to do, and I don't know anything more joyous to do when I get it. And I'm very pleased with that essay. If you read it in its published form, there is one unfortunate copy editing error in the first paragraph. I'll tell you about it later.
That's incredibly embarrassing.
You mean what I said was embarrassing?
No, you have a typo in your story.
Oh.
Well, one of the challenges that I discuss in my book has to do with very much with my ancestors, and I've got quite involved with the Willie Hancart and the Martin Hancart story, and particularly with Martin's Cove in Wyoming. I was quite involved in the BLM's attempt first to, the church's attempt first to buy and then to lease 1,000 acres along the historic trails. And it was, what got me through, because was actually this notion of truth. I felt, and still feel, that a lot of the stories have been completely mythologized, and there was really no reason for it. The story itself of the Hancart disasters is so interesting and so fascinating, and so many layers. Just tell the story as it is. And that was the truth for me of my great-great-great-grandparents who both died, and their daughter who survived in 1856. So when, in Wyoming, there are the U.S. Craig Thomas and the assistant director of the Department of Interior was saying that 150 people died at Martin's Cove, when that was clearly and patently false. I just wanted people to tell the truth. about what happened, because that's all you needed to do. But of course, if you're a Utah Mormon with pioneer ancestors, you don't really do much except take their stories as a great faith-enhancing experience, which cheapens it, in my opinion. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy. And very interesting, because so many decisions were made that affected it. Anyway, that, I suppose, put me at odds with my family. We don't talk about things in my family, so I have no idea whether they care or are even interested. I just wanted the truth as far as it could to come out. And fortunately, a lot has been done to make the story more accurate. But, yeah, so that was difficult. That's my point.
Did you finish, Kevin?
I think so. I'll
just quickly say, the thing that was hardest for me was to, after I got divorced, my whole idealism about the Mormon thing just was blown up totally. And part of me just said, well, it didn't work. I tried to do everything I was supposed to do, and it didn't work, so I don't care. But what I had to face with was the person I met at the I don't care part. And she wasn't wholly righteous and all these things that I wanted. And I had a young son who had hemophilia, and I dealt with this in the book. But he was fighting with his brother one morning, and this is about 3 years old, and I just went like that to him, and he died of a cerebral hemorrhage the next day. So this has been extremely, I mean, just what I heard Holly sort of, that the pain is huge, and it's still there, and you can write about it, you try to come to terms with it all, but, you know, and it's a very useful thing to be able to write about it. It's helped me, it's better than all the therapy you can get. But I didn't necessarily like the person I became, and I realized I wasn't this good Mormon girl that I always had kidded myself I was, but then it was like, I am a human being, and a wonderful person. I'm all these things, and it's okay. So with my memoir, I wanted to say to people, you know, just like who you are, you know, accept who you are and accept the mistakes you make. We all make them, and it's called eternal progression, not eternal arrival. So, you know, that's what I hope to say.
Yes, I have a friend who teaches an MFA program, not a member of the church. She was telling me recently that she has a LDS student, and her thesis was growing up Mormon, and it was a lovely linear story with no conflicts and no problems, a faith-promoting story, and she, you know, scratched her head about that. But I chuckled because I would expect that would be the kind of story so many Latter-day Saints would want to tell, feel obligated to. In contrast, there's a book called Leaving Church by an Episcopal priest, last name of Brown. I can't remember her first name. She pastored a church in a lovely North Georgia mountain village, stone church, the ideal what she wanted. After a few years, she suddenly realized that she wasn't getting out of church what she wanted to get out of church. Now, it wasn't a crisis necessarily of faith or a question of God. Was a crisis about church. And the interesting thing is that churches all over are inviting her to come speak. So she hasn't been alienated from churches. So my question is, do you think a Latter-day Saint could write a book like that, Deseret book, would publish it and carry it?
Oh, sure.
I'll answer this question. We would hope somewhere that would happen, Parker. And I think there's going to be... the reception I've had from my book, which I have thought would be scary, has been really quite lovely. From very wonderful LDS people who are really in the church, so to speak. So I think that there is a place for it. But it'd have to be pretty...
At Sunstone, but I'm wondering about Deseret Book.
Well, Deseret Book, we won't worry about Deseret Book. Just get it out there somewhere. Okay. Did anybody have anything else to say about it? Okay.
Well, her book wasn't published by a religious press, right?
Barbara, then what, Leaving Saints?
Right.
I don't think
no,
so.
No, 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 no. Leaving Church.
Oh, Living Church. That's what I meant, Living Church. Who published that? I have the book and I haven't read it yet.
Who published
Living Church?
I think it's one of the major publishers.
Okay, so it wasn't a religious press.
Okay, so yeah, Desiree Book wouldn't do it.
I just have to say really quickly, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from writing was at a BYU writing conference, and you'd never think, and this is when I was just starting out, and it was Heber Woolsey, I think, but he said, if you want to make it in the writing world, don't try to do it in Mormon hierarchy. Just go outside, publish in journals, publish wherever you can, get yourself some, you know, establish yourself in that way. Don't try to go through those traditional routes, and it's really, it worked for me, and so if that works for you, try it. Paul?
So I'm looking forward to Holly's review of regional single Mormons Halloween dates, so I can disagree with it most at more length. But no, I.
Paul, I am always right. You have to.
So what I want to just mention in response to what Holly said, I think there are probably dozens of Mormon girls out there who have prayed about marrying a particular person in the temple and got what they felt was just a solid positive answer, and who later realized that, no, that probably wasn't what I thought it was. And so now we have Elna Baker, a 27-year-old Mormon virgin living in New York City, and later in the book she finds herself lying in or on a bed with a non-Mormon person who she has some affection for, who has a real penis, and there they are together. And when we read that, do we say, well, that would never happen? Well, of course it happens. And this person happens also, Elna Baker happens to be a comedian with some self-irony. And when she describes the events of her life, I think she's describing the naivete that she's had and still has to some degree, and he's trying to deal with it and put it out there. And I think this kind of honesty that says, yeah, this stuff happens and I'm a real person and it's happening to me, is more what we need more of. And I like the book a lot, so that's where I'm coming from.
Well, that's great. You know, fabulous. It's funny. Yes, it's funny. But I will tell you that the editor and proofreader at Dialogue, both of them contacted me to tell me that it was one of the most remarkable reviews they'd ever read and that they were absolutely swayed by it. And I look forward to your recanting.
The way you write.
It's funny. And yeah, she tells us how, she's trying to seduce her boyfriend, Matt, and she derails the project by saying, you really need to pray and find out if God is real, which is, you know, not exactly most people's definition of pillow talk. And you know, the fact remains that within the Mormon culture and our ideas of truth-telling, it's mediated through our bodies. And Elna has a particularly fraught relationship with her body, and the extent to which my review is called The Plan of Stagnation, because what Elna is looking for, as I said, is something that will relieve her from the obligation to revisit her decisions or to reconsider her life. And there are so many things that she does not consider in the first place, so failing to reconsider her lack of consideration is really intellectually and spiritually depressing. I laughed. When she picked up the tangerine and threw it at that really mean-spirited family home evening group leader lady and hit her right between the eyes and she fell over, the woman tipped over backwards in her chair, I laughed out loud. But ultimately, I was just so sad for Elna, And I was just so sad for what it says about Mormon culture and Mormon women and our alienation from our bodies. And yeah. And you know, I mean, it's and what I mean, you know, all this stuff about mirrors and blah blah blah. Just trust me, Paul. You'll be writing me an apology.
And on that note, we have to end because it's important. Thank you for being here.